The following program is brought to you by Total Theater Online. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the staff or management of WGBB. You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Good Dave to you. Welcome to Dave's Gone By, 90 minutes of talk radio, music, and comedy heard every week at this time on this station, WGBB AM 1240, and also live audio streaming on the internet at am1240wgbb.com. You know, I tell people that, and damned if I still don't get asked half a dozen times a week, hey, I can't get your show on the radio, is it ever going to come to New York City or Connecticut or wherever? And I say, yes, I hope so, especially to wherever, because that's an untapped market as far as radio goes. No, but I love to syndicate the program. I love to see this little thing I do get recognition and reach the next level. But until it does, if you are in Manhattan or the tri-state area or the Midwest or Los Angeles, well, you wouldn't be listening now unless you were listening on the computer, which you can do now. When I am giving out the URL of the radio station's website, am1240wgbb.com, I'm not just giving them a free plug. It's not part of a mandatory station ID. It's telling everybody that if your computer has a sound card and basic software for Windows Media, or I assume it's Mac equivalent, you can hear this show wherever you are. am1240wgbb.com and click on the button that says Listen Live. So, if your radio gets the show, but reception is bad or it's staticky, or if you know friends and relatives from out of town who would enjoy the program because they're as depraved and deranged as you are, for gosh sakes, send them the URL, tell them about the show, and let them know that they can listen Monday nights, 6:30 to 8 p.m. Eastern, online. And please, understand I also recite it specifically as am1240wgbb.com. If you just type wgbb.com, you won't get anything. The radio station doesn't own that domain name. But am1240wgbb.com gets you to the station, gets you to this show, and the schedule for other shows throughout the week. I know I sound patronizing and probably am burdening you with the obvious, but I do find myself answering questions repeatedly that I thought were pretty clear, maybe because I work with computers so much, or maybe because I'm at the radio station and see exactly how the live stream goes through. But either way, it's frustrating when people who've been on the show's email list for months tell me they can't get the program because they don't live in the area, and it just doesn't occur to them that Mr. Dell and Mr. Gateway and Mr. Gates have made possible what Marconi couldn't. So please, tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell the world that the world can listen to Dave's Gone By every Monday night, 6:30 to 8 p.m. on WGBB Radio, or say it with me now, am1240wgbb.com on the internet. And if they ask, you know, they ask you why they should listen, you can tell them it's because the show is a mix of smart talk, silly talk, special talk, and music. And you can point to this very episode as a prime example. That's because we will be doing comedy. We've got a great interview guest, and we'll have a musical set at the end of the program. The longtime listeners know that every week we do the News Gone By, our version of the Daily Show weekend update-style razzing of items in the news. Among the topics this week, China, Al-Qaeda, Rwanda, Paris, insider trading and corpse honking, the Georgia Bulldogs, and the Cincinnati Reds. But that's just one segment of this remarkable program. We'll also be paying a musical tribute to Neil Sedaka. I know, not exactly the hippest cat in the universe, but when you've written 1,000 songs, and at least a dozen are keepers 45 years after they topped the charts, you were doing something right. Now, Sedaka turns 65 this coming Saturday, officially a senior citizen, which only shows just how young he was when he was writing hit after hit in the late 50s. So we'll hear a couple of Sedaka classics. They're still fun, and get a little Sedaka trivia, including this tidbit. Did you know that Neil Sedaka's most recent album, released last year, is a collection of 13 traditional songs, most of them in Yiddish. And it's called Brighton Beach Memories on the Sameach label. Unfortunately, I don't have a copy of the album, but it's amazing how as they get older, they all come back to their roots. So he's singing By Mir Bis Du Shein, the theme from Exodus, My Yiddish Mama. Actually, that song has history behind it. In his 1961 debut on the Ed Sullivan Show, Sadaka was going to do three songs, and the last one was My Yiddish Mama. Sullivan objected to it. The show's producer got skittish about it. They thought it was too Jewish. 2 hours before airtime, they relented. And Sullivan, I guess, didn't want to seem anti-Semitic. So Sadaka sang it, and the reaction was overwhelmingly positive. So I guess after all these years, it's still a kick for him to do that number. Also, his mother-in-law apparently died the year before, so that sparked a lot of memories and religious pull. So he'll be doing that song and a bunch of others also at a benefit concert for the Volksbühne Yiddish Theater on June 3rd at Carnegie Hall. The Klezmatics are taking part, a bunch of other people too. Anyway, I'm not here to push the concert, not here to sell the record, just here to wish Neil Sedaka a happy birthday musical salute a little later in the program. But we're going to stay on the Jewish theme because I also have a special guest live in the studio, Jay Kolos, K-H-O-L-O-S, a TV writer and producer for a few decades now. Jay decided to do something theatrical, also something meaningful to his past and his heritage. So he sat down and wrote a musical, book, music, and lyrics, a story about Russian Jewish immigrants who settle on the Lower East Side and try to rise above poverty, rise above being in a strange culture with a different language, try to scratch out a new life in America. You can almost see it as a would-be sequel to Fiddler on the Roof, like what happens to these people once they leave Anatevka and reach New York. Now, Kolos' musical is A Stoop on Orchard Street, and it's playing at the Mazer Theater, downtown New York, just a block or two from the milieu the show depicts. It's been running since July and doing just fine. In fact, plans are afoot for a Florida production and a tour. I've seen the show. It's very nice, amusing, touching, some very talented people in the cast, and the story and the characters are very heartfelt. It hooks you in, which is half the battle of any musical. So we will talk to Jay Kolos in just a couple of minutes. And before that, I only need to remind you, in this age of FCC paranoia, that this program is rated DGB-13. That is, the Dave's Gone By equivalent of PG-13. We don't show nipple. We don't say the F word. We only use racial epithets in a meaningful context. Okay, we do the occasional fart joke, and sometimes we'll let a penis or a bastard slip through, but hey, it's nighttime, and this station has no money, so if the FCC fines us, they're out of luck. But if you can handle a little salty content now and then, we promise not to leave a bad taste in your mouth. So stick around now till 8 o'clock with Dave's Gone By. I'm Dave, Dave Lefkowitz, radio personality, theater critic, playwright, and Yiddishkeit. And we'll start the 68th edition of this program, Stoop the Conquer, with my guest, Jay Kolos, right after this. We're going to be talking theater with my special guest, Jay Kolos, but before I introduce him, I don't know if you were listening to the 6 o'clock half hour that Joe Salzone does here on WGBB tonight, but since we are in a theatrical mode, I do want to tell everybody, if they haven't heard, that they found Spalding Gray's body floating in the East River over the weekend. They've identified it. It's him. He was wearing the same pants. He had no ID because he had left it at home before he went out for a walk. So one of the first episodes I did of this program was when he did that sort of half-suicide attempt, half-not, of diving into a local lake. And, you know, I talked all about it, and I was saying I hope he would feel better and get better since that accident and since his terrible depressions. I guess he hasn't, and it's a little disconcerting. It's a little sad, so just want to wish him a farewell. But I want to, in a much happier vein, want to welcome someone who's very much alive and very active and hopefully not at all depressed, because he's got something very to be very happy about. He's got kind of a hit show going on. It's an off-Broadway show playing at the Mazur Theater in downtown Manhattan. We'll tell you all about it. It's called A Stoop on Orchard Street, and involves basically Jewish immigrants coming into this country, all living in sort of the New York ghetto of Orchard Street and the Lower East Side, and how they cope, how they deal with being in that situation, and what they do to kind of go past it and move out further into the world, and on some level also assimilate. So, Jay Kolos is my guest. He's not only done this theater project, but he's been in television for like 30 years. So much to talk about, so we'll get right into it. Welcome, Jay.
Thank you. I'm really delighted to be here, honestly.
Good, and especially in this weather. Thank you for coming out to Babylon. Yeah. My gosh. I know we're supposed to be in Freeport, but actually we're in Babylon. Yeah. So, congratulations, first of all. I mean, it's been running since July.
Yeah, we actually showcased this production in Nashville, Tennessee, of all places. It was literally a showcase that gave me a chance. I wrote it also, so it gave me a chance to see what it looked like and with an audience. Everything went great, and we brought it to New York. We started rehearsals and opened up July 8th, and I think last Friday was our 300th show. So,
Mazel tov.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Actually, one of the weird things, when I was doing a little bit of research on the show, that Jack Carter was in it at one point.
Well, Jack Carter was the person that we brought into Nashville. I was concerned. We did it at it was a 600-seat venue, so it wasn't that small. But it wasn't the kind of venue that was known for theater. It was actually a Jewish community center, and I was concerned that it would be perceived as a, lack of a better term, a temple play, that it would not be taken seriously. So the part of the old man, it's an ensemble cast, basically, but the part of the old man, I decided I would try to bring somewhat of a name in, and at least someone that I thought could play that part, and also make sure that we got an audience, and it all kind of worked, and we did. We sold out those three shows, and but mainly for me, I was able to see the show up and running, hear what worked, didn't work, where the laughs were, where the emotion was, and from that, I reworked the show somewhat, changed some songs, wrote some new things, and not that long after, brought it to New York and opened up July 8th.
I mean, I have to say that the guy playing the old man, and it's basically the story of him looking back at his childhood years and his dad, who is a rather difficult person, and
right.
a long-suffering mom, and all those colorful characters in his life. You've got a wonderful guy playing him now.
His name is Lon Gary. He's also our director. Lon actually started with the show in Nashville, and Lon and I got along really well. And as a writer, you probably know this as well as I do, when you do write something and you turn it over, whether it's to a director or whomever, there's always concern about how they're going to take your work. And so with Lon, he and I ended up finishing each other's sentences, and I really felt very good about asking him to direct this show, not only to act in it, but to direct it. And it's worked out beautifully. We have a wonderful relationship in the sense that I trust his judgment, he trusts mine, and we've been able to continue to, make the show better and better and better.
Yeah. And also, I have to say, on the other end of the scale, the night I saw it, the young boy who was in the part, I don't remember the actor's name, but I don't know, he must have walked in, done about 30 seconds of whatever his prepared piece was, and probably both looked at each other, you and Lon Gary, and said, "Oh, him."
It could be. Benny, the character Benny, who is a 10-year-old, who is the old man as a young boy. We have had four or five of them over a period of time. We actually generally have two or three that are in the show because we do eight shows a week, and these kids do go to school and all that. But two of them we retired because their voices changed and they got too big, and you probably either saw Max or you saw, anyway, yes, we have some wonderful Bennies. They're just terrific kids and actors, and very smart, kids that can memorize like they can do, and
he seemed like a showbiz kid.
Yeah.
He had that little panache thing. I was like, oh, okay.
Yes.
here's a question, I guess, that you get asked each and every time, but it is legit. What prompted you to tell this story in this particular way?
Really, what was the catalyst was I took a tour of the Tenement Museum, the Lower East Side Tenement Museum. I was not living in New York at the time. We're not talking about that long ago, a couple of years ago. And I had just been remarried to Paula, who actually also, we have lots of family in the show now, not on stage, but behind the scenes. And Paul and I came to New York. I wanted to go to there was an old-timers game at Yankee Stadium, and I wanted to do this for a long time. It was the Yankees and the Dodgers, and we were actually living for a short time in Nashville. So we flew in, staying at the hotel. I got great seats right behind third base and spent the entire day that day, you know, at Yankee Stadium, not only with the old-timers game, but with the game itself afterwards. And my son was there with us as well, Philip. The next morning, and we were 6 or 7 hours in the hot sun. It was a July. Yeah. The next day in the hotel, Paula said I had heard about this thing called the Lower East Side Tenement Museum. Can we go down there? And I said, you know, Paula, I really don't want to do that. I mean, you know, I just like to hang around at the bar here or do something or just relax. And my son says, listen, Dad, she spent 6 hours with you in that hot sun. The least you can do what you'd like to do. So we went down there. We took the tour. I walked into that tenement, and all the stories my grandfather told me started to come back to me. It was the most amazing thing, stories that I really hadn't paid a lot of attention to as a kid, but he used to tell me all these things, and that's kind of what started. We walked back out on the stoop, literally on the stoop, and I said to Paula and to my son, I think this might make a good idea for a musical, and that's kind of how it started.
And how long between that moment and the first draft?
It took a little while because I was working on another project. I actually was working on a movie project called Turnstiles, and I had finished the script, and we had started the pre-production. 9/11 happened, and some of the financing, I had some of it, and there was some other money in it, and it fell out, or it started to fall out. And the tone of the script, the story was such that I didn't think was appropriate at that period of time, and so I said, well, let me go work on this, and that's kind of what happened. And I started working so it took me about 6 months to write it.
Obviously, you end up revising it here and there later.
Yeah, right? I mean, the basic story, the book, those songs, I wrote a couple of songs first, just to see if that kind of, and then I kind of worked into the book, and then I kind of went back to the songs, but it was about a 6 month process. However, it has evolved. Even after we opened, we've made changes.
Tell us just a little bit about the synopsis. I mean, I give a vague idea, but I think it can be a little.
Well, I think using the Fiddler, a lot of people refer to it as the Day After Fiddler, which actually to me is quite a compliment. But it is. It's as if that cast and Fiddler and the Anatevka scene, as they're circling and walking around and at the very end when they've been really kicked out of their village, they all split, go off somewhere, and of course most of them ended up coming into Ellis Island, the Lower East Side. So the story picks up about 3 years after they have been on the Lower East Side, and they are itching to get out. They want to go uptown. And these are these Russian Jews that did make a huge difference in my life, because I come from that, but also the artists and the actors and the writers and the lawyers and the, as we say in the show, the good nicks and the not so good, the mockers and the knockers. It's basically
FCC will not let us say knockers.
Well, basically, it's their attempt to break out of those of that Lower East Side area and to move uptown, and it's somewhat based on, well, it's the immigrant story. It's the Russian Jewish immigrant story. It's every immigrant story in ways. We have audiences are very mixed. We certainly get our share of Jewish audiences, because that's the sense of it. But we get a lot of other groups that come in, Italians and Irish, etc., that say that's their story as well.
greenhorns, but not for long. And you see the progression in the show, how some people get a little bit left behind, but most of the characters actually do tend to move upwards by the end of the show. Unfortunately, one of the protagonists, he does it the wrong way, and he does get left behind. I don't want to give away the whole plot.
You're talking about the father?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's... but you know, also without giving away the plot, there... the fact of life is that there was a lot of desertion by fathers during that period of time. A lot. There was an X percent. I think it was about 3 to 5% of the fathers deserted. What would happen in many cases is some of these were arranged marriages in the old country, and they came over here, and then perhaps the man sees New York and sees, you know, and wheels start turning and things start happening, and it's no longer living in a little shtetl or and they left. So in some cases they left and abandoned their families. But so there's a little bit of that in right. in the show.
I also, it's weird that you mentioned that. I read a Theodore Dreiser novel a couple of months ago, not Jewish at all. It's just like Mining Town kind of thing. And again, the father, it wasn't in the sense of doing something wrong. In fact, book was about the daughter perceived as being doing something wrong. But he ended up having to leave the family just to make the living. I mean, he could go and live by the factory and basically hole up there and work 14 hours a day, 6 days a week, and just squirrel away all the money and still send it back. So I assume there was also some of that as well.
Yeah, in our case, it's more that the father is really trying to make it not the hard way, and he's looking for an easy way to make money, an easy way to move up, and which is unfortunate.
You did mention that this was loosely based on your grandfather's story. And what was his story?
Well, I mean, he came over in about the year 1907, and he and his brothers and his father and mother, I think there were about 10. As a matter of fact, I went to the Ellis Island Registry, and I looked up I was able to find the manifest that they actually came over the ship. In fact, we use many of the names in the show our family names, or even the ship was the name of the ship that he came over on. And although eventually he ended up in Pittsburgh, but he did live for a time on the Lower East Side. And one of his brothers had worked hard to bring his wife or future wife over, which is a little bit of what's in our show. We have a song, we have a character called Sarah and Simon. Sarah is in the old country. Simon is trying to get her over, fighting hard to get her over, and that's a song that really expresses his love to bring her here. And it's one of the ballads in the show that people seem to enjoy.
There's a song on the show. There's a song on the CD called Sarah. It's the one that's like halfway. It comes in from another song. That's the one. So it'll take like a minute or two to set up, and we'll probably play it at the top of the hour when we do our station ID. We'll do kind of a weird transition into it, because I also want to get into those years in TV before you did this show. This was your first theatrical.
This is my first musical. I've been around the entertainment business most of my life, and I've written a little bit, you know, music and things. But this was a whole other experience. It's definitely my first major theatrical experience.
And so far, it's been
so far good. So good.
You had actually, before we even get to the television stuff, I do want to. I mean, the critics have been positive and negative. I mean, it's gotten mixed. A lot of good reviews.
Actually,
it's an audience show.
Yeah, actually, we had a couple critics come in during previews, which is really not supposed to happen. And so there was a negative review or two that happened early on. Most of the reviews since then, after we opened, and particularly in the last number of weeks, have been phenomenal. We just got something from one of the papers that named us the best musical of 2003, best off-Broadway musical. We got something the other day from a publication, Best Of, that said the finest piece of musical theater in New York. We've had some wonderful reviews and wonderful comments. I would say majority of them have been positive, but certainly there's been some negative. And some of the negative had to do with the fact that some of the people thought it was a little schmaltzy, a little too sentimental. But that's what the story's about, and we weren't trying to do the Triangle Fire. We were trying to do a story about, the audiences love it, and we keep packing them in, so we're doing something right.
Now, forgive me if I get economic on
sure.
this, but I am curious about this, because, you know, I've been following theater for about 20 years. You've got a show, it's in a house that seems to seat about, what, 200?
Yeah.
Or 200-seat house.
199.
199. You've got a large cast. Because it is a musical.
About 18 in the cast.
18 people.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an equity?
No, it's a non-equity.
Non-equity, okay. Cool, but you are paying.
We pay, oh, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
And you have not just like a piano.
We have a six-piece orchestra.
Six-piece orchestra in this place. So that's a lot of humans. Is there profit?
Yes.
Can that be done?
Yes, absolutely. It can only be done, though. Well, I shouldn't say only be done. It can be done. Because of its non-equity status. That's not to say that equity isn't a wonderful institution, because it is. But we could not have done this without it being a non-equity. And
has that equity been breathing fire
on
your butt?
No, I mean, not really. I'm not sure that they would have any interest. I mean, we're basically a non-equity show, and if the actors, you know, they wouldn't be working, and the fact is that 8 months later, we have broken the record. We broke the record at the Mazer Theater. It's a 115-year-old theater where Eddie Cantor played Zero Mostel. Mark Twain used to appear there. We're the longest-running show in the history of the Mazer, believe it or not.
And I guess that theater itself is a non-equity venue.
Well, you don't
it's a nice little theater.
Yes, you do not have to be a equity or non-equity theater to do a non-equity show. Me as an outside producer, if I have a non-equity production, I can rent or what's called four-wall that theater.
Hmm.
It could even be an equity theater, and it doesn't matter.
Well, you couldn't do that on Broadway. I mean,
no, you couldn't do it on Broadway, but you can do it in you know, off Broadway, and certainly on the road, which is what we're doing. Also,
we have
a second company opening up in Fort Lauderdale, in a nicer, a big theater at the Stage Door Theater in Fort Lauderdale. And we have a road tour that will start in September.
And the economics really work out. So people are paying, what is it, for like $40, $50?
Average prices, well, $45 is the high. Uh-huh.
For tickets. And
mm-hmm.
you do a good house, then I guess it can work out. That it's nice to hear, I have to say. If you get, you know, the audiences coming in, you can actually make a go of it.
Yes, if you ask me whether one can get rich just in that environment here in New York, the answer is rich is relative, but the
right.
answer is probably no. But in the terms of it having a New York base, continuing to run it probably run for several years, and then taking out on the road, that's where the economics work out very nicely.
Cool. Well, we're working out very nicely here with Jay Kolos, the author and composer of A Stoop on Orchard Street, now playing at the Mazer Theater, has been since July, and very nice of him to join me here on Dave's Gone By on this March 8th, and you're listening to us on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com. We're going to play another selection from the... Is this CD available, by the way? Is it?
Yeah, actually, they're available. Tower Records has it, as a matter of fact, and through websites and at the venues. We've actually sold quite a few, which surprised the heck out of me because we came from nowhere with the show, but it sells.
Yeah, if you have them in the back of the theater at the end, people will want
people
that.
People buy them
theater.
There, yeah.
yeah. Mm-hmm. So let's hear what we were talking
this
about.
This is a song right. called Sarah, which is kind of a ballad, the love song, and one of the love songs in the show.
Sarah, Sarah.
Called Sarah from A Stoop on Orchard Street, now playing off-Broadway at the Mazer Theater. The author is with us, Mr. Jay Collis. Thanks again for joining us so much.
Sure.
And as promised, I want to get to before the theater career. You had a television career for a couple of decades. Now, how did that first start? You were growing up in L.A. So.
I was, yes, I'm an L.A. native. Grew up on the west side of Los Angeles. My first I was going to University of Southern California, and I was fortunate enough to get a job with CBS TV City, which is in Beverly and Fairfax. And I was a page, basically. Used to take people that would come in, all the tourists that would come in from all over the country, and take them on tour and show them Lucille Ball's dressing room and Jack Benny's this mm-hmm. and all the and Linklater's studio and all the shows that were going on at the time, and that was my kind of, although I had been around the business a little bit just because I grew up in that area, that was my first exposure. And then I used to, you know, I got a chance to do a little work on some of those shows, some of those great, great old shows.
I mean, speaking of some of those names that you mentioned, I realize you were a kid, but any memories or experiences of people like Jack Benny or Lucille Ball? Or
I remember, for example, Jack Benny, who was a wonderful man, just a very kind, and I was in awe. I remember working his show, and there would be a lunch break. And he would, outside, they would be catered, and he would invite all of the pages over and some of the non-stars and sit around. He'd tell show business stories, and it was just great. You know, he was just a wonderful man. Jimmy Durante was also like that, who who used to, you know, appear from time to time on CBS shows. And there was, I didn't really, I would see some of the other people around, but of course all of them, but Jack Benny stands out on my mind as just being a real mensch. Mm-hmm.
Now, how did you go from being a page, because there's 4 million pages at ABC, CBS, NBC, to actually really working your way into the biz?
What I really did was I ended up going to work for an advertising agency, and then I went out on my own. I worked for an agency in Los Angeles for a couple of years, and then decided that I didn't like working for anybody, so I went out on my own and built up a fairly substantial advertising agency, which kind of led me more into entertainment projects as well, because I wanted to do those. And so I started doing some television things. Radio, actually. I did a series with Rod Serling called the Hollywood Radio Theater.
Nice Jewish boy, Rod Serling.
Yes.
How did that, I mean, that's, you know.
I had the idea that, now, this is, the time on this would be in the 70s. Early 70s, I believe, and dramatic radio, as it was known, you know, where you had stories and sound effects and all that, had really died out before that. And I thought, well, maybe there was an opportunity to kind of bring it back. So I came up with the idea of doing these old radio shows, but done today, done with great stories, using film stars or television stars. And I asked Rod if he would host it, and he did. And I syndicated it initially in about 75 stations, and eventually licensed it to Mutual Broadcasting. They ran it for a number of years. And then CBS Mystery Theater came out, which was another similar kind of thing. And that's kind of how that evolved.
Any memories or what was it like working with Rod Serling?
Rod was I traveled with him quite a bit, because when we promoted the show, we'd go around to different stations, and he was also a wonderful guy. His problem was he had a difficult time saying no, and so he would end up doing a lot of projects, a lot of things maybe that he maybe should not have done, and I think he got a little frustrated, because he was a wonderful writer. You know, that was basically his early TV days, some of his work. But he did game shows, and, you know, he did a little bit of everything. Yes, he did. He became more of a personality, really, later on, and that's kind of what he was maybe known for. But he was just a great guy, and very supportive of my project.
Yeah, I noticed also you did a radio project later years with John Ritter.
No, actually, it was a television show.
It was TV, sorry.
Yes, I did a show called History and the Company of Children, which was a little vignette series that ran, I believe, on USA Network for a number of years, and it was all about children that had made an impact in history, and John was the host of that. That was while he was doing Charlie's Angels.
And I've heard only good things about him, too.
Also, terrific guy. I mean, I've been very fortunate. You know, there are a few not-so-good guys. Yeah,
come on, you got to tell one, like, dish story. But someone dead. But any really, like, you know, jerky people you had to deal with because of, you know, the situation?
Well, let me say that Jack Carter wasn't one of the most difficult people I've ever dealt with. But Jack is an old-time original Vod, you know, he's just a tough guy and knows what he wants, and he wasn't easy, but he's a pro, and he delivered for me, but he was not an easy guy to work with backstage. He made a few of our actors cry on occasion. Yeah, he just was real demanding and very tough, but that's the style that he worked, and that's always the way he's been, and, you know, you have to know that going in. There are, you know, they're just, he's a perfectionist, and he was not an easy guy. Off stage, on stage, he was terrific.
Well, yeah. I heard that about Phil Silvers.
Yeah. There's they grew up. A lot of them, I think, and I'm not going to psychoanalyze this, I guess, but I probably am. Again, I think a lot of it has to do with the rejection factor. These guys are. Well, what fascinated me when I meet these, I'm a friar too, so that I do see some of these great, you know, talented comedians and And what fascinates me is they never want to retire. You know,
look at Jackie Mason.
Right? Yeah, well, yeah, Jackie Mason's still relatively young. I'm talking about, you know, the Henry Youngmans of the world, who's no longer with us, but they were in their 90s. George Burns was, right, you know, looking forward to his 100th birthday, and he wanted to perform at the London Palladium, I believe. There's something about the business of getting up there and performing, and they just don't want to give it up. You don't hear that from, frankly, people that are in the insurance business. basically, a lot of people talk about what they're going to do when they retire. Entertainment people say,
like, oh, my God, I can't imagine.
I can't imagine not
what
doing
am I
going
to do when the phone stops ringing? That's
or, yeah, I need the laughter, I need the applause. I saw Mr. Saturday Night again the other night.
Oh, the Billy Crystal movie? Yeah.
Which I love. It's a great movie. It probably made $1.50 at the box office, but it's a terrific movie. And that really does say it all. You know, his character basically wasn't an amalgamation of a bunch of those guys.
Right. So do you have any, since you've worked in television, radio, and theater, you're probably very close to the theater now, but do you have a preference?
I think I will continue to love the theater more than anything because it has a lot of the entrepreneurial things that I really enjoy, and it gives me a little more control over my destiny. The other things, television is fraught with a lot of people that can have influence and not getting something on the air. I can, if I believe in a project, I can get it at least mounted in the theater business.
Yeah.
Can't necessarily do that in television unless you own a network.
Then you can get it stuffed and mounted, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
We only have like a couple of minutes, or I can believe how fast the time goes on. Well, that's why we do it. Exactly, because the time just...
Absolutely.
One quick question, and then I also want to set up, we'll go out on music. Is there another song that we might want to play?
We want to do maybe a little bit of Lipschitz, which is all about changing your name. It's all about so many of us, don't have the names that we came over, that our ancestors came over with when they came into Ellis Island or something. And this is a song about changing your name.
Okay, we're going to set that up in a minute. We still have a minute or two.
Sure.
Because I first of all, want to remind everybody to go see A Soup
on Orchard Street.
And it's on Mesa Street between
East
Broadway.
No, it's on 197 East Broadway on the Lower East Side.
Mm-hmm. And for tickets, it's telecharge 212-239-6200. As I said, I saw the show. It's a very, very nice musical. 212-239-6200. Because they've got a revival of Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway now. Have you seen it? And what do you think of the so-called controversy about it?
I have not seen the current Fiddler. I've seen Fiddler in various forms, 20 times. I love Fiddler. The controversy about the Fiddler on the Roof here apparently is that it doesn't have a Jewish soul, whatever that means, and I think that probably means that maybe they took some of that flavor out of it. I just don't know how you can make Fiddler a bad show. It's a great yeah, piece of work.
And, I mean, I have to say, I saw the production, and it's very good. I mean,
yeah,
there are things I argued with,
yeah,
and some of the casting is a little odd,
yeah,
but it's a pretty good thing. Oh, I think I hear is that the music going already? I think I've got to finish this segment. So, Jay Kolos, thank you very, very much.
Pleasure.
Best of luck with A Stoop on Orchard Street.
Thank you.
Villages from cities big and small, pogroms and crazy Cossacks, we survived them all.
Welcome back to Days Gone By. It's time for the News Gone By, a look at events of the past week from a stupid perspective. We begin with world news. I don't think anybody will miss communist China, but is everybody ready for capitalist China? It's basically here, what with the Chinese government making brisk strides into a market economy, the latest, a vote to allow people and businesses to own private property, something that hasn't been seen over there since the early 1950s. Party leaders are making this new ideology a priority, hoping to encourage investments and entrepreneurship, so much so that they've even started broadcasting a new reality TV series. In it, a group of young men and women all vie for the chance to be hired as an assistant to a rich, powerful mogul. The Chinese deny they're simply copying an American program, but hey, come on. The show's called The Apprentice, and it stars a millionaire named Donald Trump. Well, you decide. Bin Laden, sociopath terrorist, or cool family guy? A Canadian documentary about a family close to Osama B says America's public enemy number one was basically a typical father and husband, said the son of one al-Qaeda fighter who was killed in Pakistan last year, quote, he had issues with his wife, and he has issues with his kids, financial issues, you know, the kids aren't listening, the kids aren't doing this and that. I swear to God, this is a quote, and it comes from a Reuters story. It comes down to the fact, says 21-year-old Abdurrahman Qadir, that Osama bin Laden is, quote, a father and he's a person, unquote. Qadir adds that bin Laden's a good athlete, he likes volleyball, and sometimes he couldn't control his kids. Then again, he did ban electricity in his compound, and he forbade his family not only from drinking Coke and Pepsi, but from putting ice in their soft drinks. The idea, says Qadir, was that Osama wanted his family to, quote, be prepared, so that if one day there is no cold water, they'd be able to survive, and it wouldn't be so difficult for them. He didn't want them to be spoiled, unquote. Well, I don't know. I don't have kids, but, you know, if I were a dad, I'd want to move to Afghanistan. Sure, it's desolate, but imagine a country where you can spoil the kids just by giving them ice. Oh, I treat my wife so well. She burnt the bread, and I let her keep her fingers. Oh, but she is a good woman. On our next anniversary, I am getting her a whole pack of M&Ms, and not just the wrapper like last year. No, but Carter's family, the dad was killed in a gun battle, a sister is still living with their mom in Pakistan, the brother is in custody at Guantanamo Bay, and the kid they interviewed for the documentary was also in Gitmo Bay, but released. He is now living in Toronto, and he says he's not into the whole suicide bombing thing, but another brother is, and that little chip off the old block says he wants to be a martyr. He says, quote, every Muslim dreams of being a shaheed for Islam. I know, it's like the old Arab joke of two Palestinian children talking, and one says, what do you want to be when you blow up? No, but this other lunatic says, this brother says, quote, everybody dreams of martyrdom. Even a Christian would like to die for their religion, unquote. Well, buddy, that's where you're wrong. Christians haven't died for their religion in 2,000 years. They've killed for it. They've set up crusades to send other people to die for it. And they've blackmailed and tortured for it. You don't believe me? Go see The Passion of the Christ. A Jew died for a bunch of Christians, not the other way around. And as for bin Laden being this year's version of Archie Bunker, well, I do hope he's prepared his children not to be too upset when they're left without ice, without Pepsi or Coke, or, God willing, without a daddy. In a related story, an internal probe has turned up disturbing news on at least 10 FBI agents, none of them, thankfully, from New York. All of them allegedly stole pieces of debris from the 9/11 World Trade Center bombing. One agent made off with more than 70 pounds of mementos. The FBI admits it had no official policy prohibiting this pilfering, however ghoulish and improper it may sound. To be fair, any archaeologists wandering around Greece or Egypt or Rome looking for ancient ruins, really they're doing the same thing. They're capturing pieces of another civilization, just like ours, that was at least partially destroyed. Of course, the ruins of their civilization didn't include cell phones, breast implants, and freeze-dried turkey sandwiches. By the way, the airline sandwiches not only withstood the blast, but actually taste better now than they do on a typical flight. Speaking of the airlines, odd behavior from a security worker at Denver International Airport. One afternoon, he simply lay down on the conveyor belt and then sent himself through the X-ray machine. Said a transportation security officer, quote, I cannot ascribe any sort of motive as to why anyone would do this, unquote. They said the worker had no history of erratic behavior or mental illness, nor any physical abnormality. Although, after the incident, they were able to tell that for lunch he had two Big Macs and an oatmeal cookie. Speaking of threats to international security, Reuters reports that last Thursday, police in a small town in Austria called in the bomb squad when a pedestrian reported a strange object buzzing in a garbage can. The bomb patrol carefully approached the green plastic bag wrapped in brown postal tape. When they touched it, it started to move. Ever so carefully, they opened the package. And inside? Well, not a bomb. A vibrator, along with some dirty movies and a porno magazine. Everybody had a good laugh. Asked if the vibrator constituted a terror threat, the captain said, "No, I guess not. We were worrying it might be a box cutter, but it's just a box opener." In entertainment news, if Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ wasn't enough torture and sadism for ya, get ready for Hotel Rwanda, set during the 100-day Rwandan massacre. The movie, to be released this spring, tells the true story of a hotel owner who risked his life to shelter 1,000 Tutsi refugees. This was in 1994, when Hutu soldiers shot, burned, drowned, and hacked more than 500,000 Tutsis to death in just 3 months. According to director Terry George, the real shame of the event was that while the slaughter was happening, the rest of the world looked the other way and did not do a thing. That is not exactly fair. I did some research on this, and I discovered that the United Nations was extremely busy that week. In fact, on the day the massacre started, they convened an emergency session in which they condemned Israel for sneezing without a permit. Speaking of the Middle East, how's this for a way to win a marital spat? A Jordanian woman, having a domestic dispute with her husband, knocked him out by hurling a tear gas canister at his head. The husband started crying, then he blacked out, and he was treated by medics. He's fine now, but quite embarrassed over the incident. I don't know why. He wouldn't be the first guy to eat his wife's cooking and then be afflicted with bad gas. Yes! 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 We are smoking with a comedy bell, signaling the Dave's Gone By Bad Pun of the Week. It's a tradition on this program every week. Actually, almost every week. Sometimes we take a break, but nearly every single week we make a play on words so ghastly we mask the stench with a comedy bell. And if you want to hear that ring-a-ding-ding associated with your own business or product or service, why not sponsor the Bad Pun of the Week? Hundreds and potentially thousands of people listen to this program every Monday night. They laugh, they cringe, they disagree, they hum along to the music. They participate in the special bizarro magic that is Days Gone By. These people are paying attention. God bless them. And if you play your cards right, they'll pay attention to you. You don't even have to play your cards right. Forget that. Just give me a couple of deuces, and I'll get your message out over these airwaves, into the ears of my adoring fans. Advertising works. It really does. And on Dave's Gone By, it works for you. Because the ads are personalized, they're fun, and they won't bust your budget. In fact, not only won't they make a dent in your wallet, they will barely even nudge your change purse. So contact Dave's Gone By and ask about purchasing a 30 or 60 second ad, or maybe sponsoring a segment of the show, or the whole show. Many options to choose, no way to lose. Call 516-295-1511 for more information. Area code 516-295-1511. Just leave me a message saying, "Hey Dave, I want to advertise on your show. What can you do for me?" And I promise someone from this program will get back to you within a matter of hours. 516-295-1511 or email davesgoneby@aol.com. We can send you a rate sheet and all sorts of ideas to help you get your message across. So call or email davesgoneby@aol.com. And maybe next week, the Dave's Gone By Bad Pun of the Week will be brought to you by you. So, don't just be good, be ponderful. In entertainment news, it was a tough week for domestic diva Martha Stewart, as jurors found her guilty on 4 counts of stock manipulation and fraud. He never believed for a second that this former stockbroker was so naive about her finances, that she didn't realize she was getting an inside tip. And when she tried to cover her tracks and told fibs to investigators, forget it, even her own defense didn't bother defending her. So I do feel a little sorry if she has to go to jail, because, let's face it, her crime was as white-collar gets. I mean, she didn't hurt massive amounts of people's pensions and retirement plans the way the Enron crew did. And as I said before on this program, all Martha did was what a lot of us would have done in the same situation. She took the advice of her broker. He warned her that she was about to lose a pile of money unless she dumped her stock. So she did. It was naughty. She should have realized the tip was hinky. She should have turned the guy in to the SEC. But would you do that to your broker if he was trying to do you a favor? They say if Martha Stewart is convicted and she loses on appeal, she could get 20 years in prison, not to mention the fine. Now, I realize they need to make an example of her, so I say she should get 4 years, 1 year, for each count she was convicted on. But parole for good behavior after 2 years, she should do the 2 years time because she lied and tried to hide the evidence. All right, maybe 1 year, but she'll have to do 1,000 hours of community service, and I mean hard labor. She should be sent to the middle of Hempstead and not be allowed to leave until it's the spitting image of Mamaroneck. Here's one from the Weird But True column of the New York Post. In Germany, a man was hauled into court after disturbing his neighbors in the middle of the night. He had been having sex for 4 straight hours, and the ruckus was so loud and relentless, the neighbors called the cops. One on listener complained to the judge, saying, quote, "What was I supposed to think? It was nothing but groaning and banging. Okay, the first 2 hours I thought it was the Mel Gibson movie, but after that..." In science news, this headline just in from AP, "Rover finds Mars was wet enough for life." Someday they'll say the same thing about Paris Hilton. Speaking of celebrity sex, fallout from the Janet Jackson Super Bowl mess just continues and continues to have mindless repercussions on American media. Everything from the firing of Bubba the Love Sponge to 5-second delays at the Oscars to Howard Stern losing radio stations to Asian comedian Sandra Tsing Lo this week being tossed off public radio for accidentally leaving in an F-word in a pre-recorded piece that was supposed to be edited out. It's all nonsense, it's all overreaction, but the censorship and the self-censorship persist. Mark Swed, music critic for the Los Angeles Times, was reviewing a production of the Richard Strauss opera Die Frau ohne Schatten, which I guess translates to The Constipated Woman. No, but in his review, he wrote that the themes of Strauss's opera were pro-life, in other words, joyous and celebratory of life and living. But a literal-minded editor changed the wording, and the review was published saying that the Strauss opera was, in fact, anti-abortion. Apparently, the paper has an editorial rule against using the phrase pro-life so as not to offend proponents of abortion. Well, much as I am pro-choice myself, you can see how political correctness and oversensitivity can lead to silly lapses in judgment. The paper ran a correction the next day, and go figure, the correction made a mistake. They mentioned the critic's name in it, and when it's newspaper policy to issue errata, but not identify who's at fault. Now, since the correction mentioned Mark Swed by name, it made him look doubly at fault, though it wasn't his blooper at all. To the newspaper's credit, they did publish a correction of the correction. Everybody's happy now, except the opera company, which is still trying to change the listing for their next production, which the Times calls Woman of the Evening Butterfly. As long as we're on the subject of abortion, here's a weird story from Tirana, Albania, where residents have been shocked by the number of eggs they've been getting that have no yolks. A professor of fowl pathology, no joke, fowl pathology at the University of Bari in Italy, told Reuters that eggs without yolks are a rare phenomenon, but they do happen, and it happens when chickens are overdriven to produce too many eggs. He also said prejudice could be responsible, since many of the farm communities in Albania are segregated and designated as whites only. Moving to sports news, goodbye, and some would say good riddance, to Marge Schott, the ballsy, chain-smoking owner of the Cincinnati Reds baseball team. Schott died last Tuesday at age 75 from a variety of ailments. The Reds had some great years, winning the 1990 World Series and sporting such players as Ken Griffey, Pete Rose, Mario Soto, and John Franco. When she bought the team, Marge Schott admitted she knew nothing about baseball, yet she nevertheless became a very hands-on owner. In fact, any purchase over $50 had to be approved personally by her. Her micromanagement was penny-wise, but it ended up costing the Reds a lot of goodwill, as she did away with many popular discounts and promotions. Didn't help that public relations were not exactly her strong suit, as she became best known for making racial remarks. She was forced to recant a statement she once made to the New York Times about Adolf Hitler, calling him a guy who started out okay but went too far. Apparently not that far, because she also admitted to owning a swastika armband. I'm not joking, by the way. Nor was it a joke when she once called outfielders Eric Davis and Dave Parker, quote, million-dollar niggers. And just to be sure we weren't mishearing her, another time during a business call, Schott said, quote, I would never hire another nigger. I'd rather have a trained monkey working for me than a nigger, unquote. Well, I come not to praise Marge Schott, but to bury her. Although, give her this, she loved her dogs, especially her beloved Shotzi, and she gave her pooches the run of Riverfront Stadium. And when the Reds won the series in 1990, she rubbed the players and manager Lou Piniella with dog hair, her way of saying good job. Ugh, there's an old saying that goes, you only get one shot in life. Somehow I think the Reds are pretty grateful for that. Staying with sports, the University of Georgia admitted to the National Collegiate Athletic Association that its academic standards for basketball players leaves a little to be desired. A few months ago, they fired assistant coach Jim Harrick and his dad, head coach Jim Harrick Sr., on the grounds that they fraudulently gave players grades of A in their coursework, even when the kids missed classes and, you know, didn't take tests. The weird part is why players would even bother to miss Jim Harrick Jr.'s class, which was called Coaching Principles and Strategies of Basketball. These are some of the questions on the test Harrick would give as the course's final exam. Now, I've said this like 20 times already in this segment. I am not making this up. Among the questions on the final exam for Coaching Principles and Strategies for the Georgia Bulldogs are, how many halves are there in a college basketball game? Okay, one hopes the students were not thrown by the fact that it's a college game, because, of course, regular basketball has extra halves. Another question, how many quarters are in a high school basketball game? Oh yeah, about 4 million quarters, if you add them up to the first-year salaries when these kids turn pro. Question number 7 reads, how many points does one field goal account for in a basketball game? Now, okay, you do have to know a smidgen about basketball to answer that one. But just in case you missed that slide presentation, question number 8 reads, how many points does a 3-point field goal account for in a basketball game? And you're given the multiple choices 1, 2, 3, and 4. Again, I'm not joking about any of this. If you want to go to the ESPN website and look up the story for yourself on Jim Harrick, H-A-R-R-I-C-K, it's all there. Another question on his exam, what color uniforms do the Georgia Bulldogs wear at home games? What color do they wear at away games? And finally, for extra credit, in your opinion, who is the best Division I assistant coach in the country? Ron Jerza, John Pelfrey, Steve Wojciechowski, or Jim Harrick Jr.? I think the really sad part of all this is not the tests themselves, but that 80% of the team thought these were trick questions and failed anyway. No, that is not true. Everybody got A's. That's part of the problem. What is true is the rule that everyone who scored higher than 50 automatically becomes a color commentator for WFAN. Better put your dinner trays down now, because, oh, this one, forget the mad cow scare. There's one woman in Ohio who will never be eating beef again. The lady was in a restaurant chain called the Red Robin near Canton when she noticed something unusual in her salad. She tried it, saying she thought it was, quote, gristle or something. Eventually, she realized it was not gristle. It was a human thumb cut off of one of the restaurant workers when he was chopping lettuce. Here's the quote of the week. County Health Commissioner William Franks reported on the woman's condition, saying, quote, physically, I think she's okay, other than hysteria, unquote. You know, that would sum it up, wouldn't it? Hey, she's fine. She just needs a week or two in a straitjacket. Oh, remember what I said about a topper? The health commissioner had one, too. Again, he added, quote, the salad should have been discarded. Thank you. Thank you, Inspector. Doing your job in Canton, Ohio, bucking for that promotion to executive. Actually, the whole thing is sort of the woman's fault, too. Before she started eating, a person at the next table pointed to her salad and muttered a warning. Unfortunately, the victim thought the other person had a lisp when he said, I think there's something in your salad, when he actually said, I think there's something in your salad. Sorry about that. And finally, in the news gone by, oh, look at this, another dead body story. The guy who oversees the cadaver program at UCLA was arrested Saturday on suspicion of grand theft. But authorities would not say what he is accused of stealing. I think we can guess. The irony is that this guy was hired a few years ago to revamp the cadaver program because so many bodies were being misplaced and misused. Authorities are still looking for the masterminds of that scheme, but alas, it seems they've gone to parts unknown. And that's the news gone by for March 8th, 2004. Please turn in your answer sheets to Dave's Gone By, P.O. Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062. Use number 2 pencils only, please, but feel free to write your comments, opinions, and suggestions for this program in the margins. Dave's Gone By, Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062, or email us at davesgoneby@aol.com. I got a nice email a few days ago from someone who said he is a longtime fan of the show. And, you know, you've got me 90% of the way there. If you tell me that, longtime fan, I'm like, yeah, 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 whatever you want, anything. So, and what he wanted, actually, was the lyrics to a song I played a couple of weeks ago when Jamie DeRoy was on the program, and she had put out a CD called Animal Tracks, Volume 5. Every couple of months she does a CD of all these different cabaret artists who do a song or two about a specific topic. This one was about animals, and the proceeds generally are towards a benefit. And this longtime fan just wanted the lyrics to a song called Dolphins that was performed by Stuart Ross, one of my favorite cabaret performers, and it's a really fun song. It's very Noel Coward-ish. So I told him, unfortunately, I didn't have those lyrics, and I couldn't find them anywhere online. But I did thank him for the email, and I'll throw this open to anybody out there. If you happen to have the lyrics to the song Dolphins, it's not even on the lyric sheet for the CD. They have information on the CD, but no lyric sheets. So, folks, you know, if you want to email me with those and I can pass them on to this listener, that would be really, really cool. Or Jamie, if you're listening and you have them, that'd be fine. I promise I'm not going to post it on the website and violate any copyright laws, especially with the FCC breathing down all our necks. But it's also a different song from Dolphins that have been done by people like Judy Collins and Tim Buckley. This is a recent song that sounds like one that was written in the 1930s. It's very funny. Maybe I'll play it again when I get a chance. Not this week, but Anyway, I'm rambling. I just wanted to say thank you to the longtime listener and to say that if you write in and you tell me what you're thinking, I will react to it. I might write back to you. I might mention you on the air. I will certainly take into consideration the things that you're saying, the things you're feeling, what you like and dislike about the show. So one more time, the email is davesgoneby@aol.com or P.O. Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062. Send me cards, send me gifts, but please, no tear gas canisters unless you want a sob story. Back after this. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com. And starting this last segment where I do my thank yous and stuff to look out for next week, unfortunately I've got to start it with an apology, sort of. I wanted to do a Neil Sedaka musical tribute at this point, but ran kind of long with Jay Kolos before, talking about A Stoop on Orchard Street, and he brought in a CD and there were all the stuff we wanted to play, so I let that segment go a lot longer because it was really cool. I was having a great time. I guess we'll do Neil Sedaka next year when he's 66, but I can certainly say happy birthday to him, and tell you just a little bit about him. I think we have time for that. So Sedaka was born March 13, 1939. He started actually with classical piano, studied at Juilliard, and Artur Rubinstein said he was one of the best high school classical pianists around. I assume that wasn't a backhanded compliment back then anyway. But all Sedaka's classmates were listening to pop and rock music. So Sedaka got into it, he formed a doo-wop group, and he ended up writing a song a day with his classmate, Howard Greenfield. He's, by the way, the name you don't hear about, but he co-wrote all those famous, famous songs, pretty much. And I think Sedaka wrote alone his first big hit. It was Stupid Cupid, which he wrote for Connie Francis in 1958. With Greenfield, he wrote Where the Boys Are, which led to a 25 million record sales number in 4 years. The two of them had a 30-year collaboration. And Sedaka also wrote for Laverne Baker and Clyde McFadden. He and Greenfield came up with, or were part of, the whole Brill Building sound. Now, when British pop came in, Sedaka didn't just, go into hiding. He wrote hits for other people, like the Monkees. In fact, When Love Comes Knocking at Your Door was a Sedaka composition, and Tom Jones recorded Puppet Man. And by the 1970s, Sedaka was primed for a comeback, and thanks to his pal Elton John, of all people, they did that duet that was big on the charts called Bad Blood, which I always found a little bit shocking just to hear Neil Sedaka say the word bitch. Rather odd, especially coming out over AM radio. That was, we're worrying about what Howard Stern and Bubba the Love Sponge are doing now. Imagine Neil Sedaka saying bitch in 1975. But he also had Laughter in the Rain, that was real big, middle-of-the-road pop. And a number that may sound a little kitschy now, but in 1975, when Love Will Keep Us Together came out for the Captain and Tennille, I mean, it's a catchy number with very propulsive music. It's a classic. And since then, Neil Sedaka has done the Billy Joel, Paul McCartney thing of dabbling in classical music. Plus, he's written new songs all this time, and he's done concerts. As I said, he's doing a gig at Carnegie Hall on June 6th as a benefit for the folks being in Yiddish theater. I haven't heard his new album, or I confess, any of his stuff since the late 70s. But it's really, let's face it, it's the early stuff that was really amazing. A couple of songs I wish I had time to play. Run, Samson, Run, which doesn't sound like one of his normal songs because it's got a banjo and a French horn in there. Different arrangements than he's used to doing. And, of course, Breaking Up Is Hard to Do, which is listed, by the way, by BMI as one of the top 50 most performed songs of the 20th century. So, breaking up is hard to do. Odd little segue here, but I've got to do it with you because I've spent almost 90 delightful minutes behind this microphone, and much as I could easily do 90 more, I wouldn't want to overstay my welcome. So let me just take the last minute or two of this program to thank a few other people. First of all, my special guest, Jay Kolos. I thank him so much for joining me in the neighborhood tonight. Go see A Stoop on Orchard Street at the Mazur Theater, 197 East Broadway, just two blocks from the Canal Street F train, and walk around the neighborhood if you haven't been there in a while. It's an education in itself. A Stoop on Orchard Street, call 212-780-2300 for tickets. Area code 212-780-2300. I want to thank engineer Joe Salzone, always a pal and a talent. And if you've never heard him do his own show, you really should, and there are many opportunities. You've heard him before on just before my show, Monday nights at 6, doing WGBB Tonight. He's also on Monday nights at 11, so stay tuned for that. And he's on Sunday nights at 11, but his most important show, the flagship, if you will, is Sunday nights at 7, Your World with Joe Salzone. And he's on TV, Sunday afternoons, 1 p.m., on Long Island Cable Channel 20. In fact, they just repeated the show I was on again yesterday. I think it was like the 8th time in 11 Sundays that they've rebroadcast that program, but what can I say? I missed your charisma. But I taped a brand new episode of Joe's show, and that's going to run either this weekend or next, so do check it out. Channel 20, Long Island Cablevision, Sunday afternoons at 1. Listen also to Long Island's Dating with comedian and talk radio goddess Bonnie D. Graham, Friday nights at 6 on WGBB. And fans of comic books and graphic novels, give a listen to The Comic Book Novice every Thursday night at 9. And any night that you're in the mood for Indian food, might I suggest the Tandoor Grill. 222 Sunrise Highway in Rockville Center. Check out the menu at tandoorgrill.com. Not tandoori. Leave off the last I for Indialicious. And finally, I have to thank my beloved wife, Joyce, for her amazing love and specialness. We're coming up on our 6th anniversary at the end of the month. As Neil Sedaka would put it, "Hon, you mean everything to me." But it also means a lot to know that you're all out there listening, enjoying, having a good time with the program. If that's true, or if it's not, let me know. DaveGongby@AOL.com is the email. And do visit the website, hometown.AOL.com/DaveGongby, for pictures, show information, plus stuff you can buy to support the show, like CDs, cassettes, my book. Cool stuff, reasonable prices. Check it out, hometown.AOL.com/DaveGongby. Well, as you can hear by the music, it's time for old Dave to leave the neighborhood this week. There's an Irish band called the Waterboys, by the way, doing Sweet Thing by another Irishman, Van Morrison. So consider it a prelude to next week's show when we get our Irish up in honor of St. Patrick's Day as well as the first day of spring. So join me next Monday night, March 15th, for Irish Spring, the 69th episode of Dave's Gone By. Until then, don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night. Don't stoop thinking about tomorrow. And gone by. That I ever felt the pain. And I will walk and talk with God and go away with me. I'll never, ever, 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 ever get so old again. Sweet things.